I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Sneak past Iranian border guards with fake Canadian credentials, track down a 70s icon, and look at lives all over the world through a colorful yet silent lens. Take refuge from that chill in the air to explore the world of an introverted college student and warm up with some dysfunctional family comedy. Today, our indie, documentary, and foreign film critics share their reviews of these and other smart films showing on area screens. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Today we're going to the movies where we'll sneak past Iranian border guards with fake Canadian credentials, we'll track down a 1970s icon, and we'll take a trip back in Kansas City history and look at the relationship between Tom Pendergast and Harry Truman. It's time for a visit with our indie documentary and foreign film critics. We'll also talk about Samsara, a new documentary that takes you to 25 countries on five continents that I found absolutely absorbing. Our film critics are here to evaluate all these and a whole lot more. They are film professor Cynthia Haynes. Cynthia, always good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Because when you're here, it's Fridays, and that's always really good. KCUR Steve Walker is also with us, Stephen. It's also good to see you.
Thank you,
too,
Steve. Stephen. Yeah. Yes, good to see you.
Bob Butler could not join us today. Well, lots of good movies today, right, Cynthia?
Absolutely.
Give me a reason to live here, right? Some good ones?
You bet. And I'm going to suggest maybe half a dozen of them, and we've got quite a few to review today. I'll start off with Tom and Harry, The Boss and the President.
Why don't you start off with Tom and Harry, The Boss and the President?
Okay.
Let's just do that.
This is a documentary by a local filmmaker, Terrence O'Malley, about the relationship between Tom Pendergast and Harry Truman.
And he was here in our show. You can go back in our archives and listen to that broadcast if you're so inclined.
Right. What day did you – do you remember when you aired it?
A couple weeks ago.
Yeah. This is a movie that's showing locally only at the Screenland Crown Center, Screenland Armor, Rio in Overland Park, and the Faro on the square in Independence.
The Faro?
Yes.
My goodness.
O'Malley's made several documentaries. He did Nellie Don, A Stitch in Time.
Which was a big hit, right?
It was. In 2006, Black Hand Straw Man, The History of Organized Crime in Kansas City. I found that absolutely fascinating. Shots Back in Time, The Union Station Massacre. Mm. And now he's got this film about Pendergast and Truman. Anyone, I think, interested in Kansas City history ought to make an effort to go see this movie this weekend. It's loaded with detailed information about the politics of Kansas City and the influence of the Irish Pendergast family. I've been to the Truman Museum, which I think is quite a good museum.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really whitewash the relationship that he had with Pendergast, but you don't get too many details. And you don't really get that much more information in this documentary. It's more about Pendergast than it is about Harry Truman. And I was always wondering through the film, to what extent was Truman corrupted by this political boss? And I don't think that really came through. The sense is that Truman stayed above it all. Besides, providing a few favors, it really didn't go into the impact that Pendergast really had on Truman in his later years as he worked his way up to the presidency.
You know, I thought this film was important from two standpoints. And again, I watched it to get ready for the interview we had with Terrence. One, I took a little more out of the relationship between Truman and Pendergast than you did, Cynthia, in terms of the impact that Pendergast might have had on Truman. I thought Terrence made the point, and other books have too, that Pendergast simply did not corrupt Harry Truman based on everything we know today. And to me, that says something just central about Harry Truman and who he was, that he was able to manage this relationship with a scoundrel and a good man and everything else wrapped up that was Tom Pendergast and sort of emerge from that relationship into the presidency without any more baggage than it had on Harry Truman. And he stood by Tom Pendergast to the very end, even when Pendergast had been his reputation had shattered because of the indictment and the tax evasion and all that stuff. And then secondly, the other standpoint, I guess, is so important. It's just a central part of Kansas City history. You don't know Kansas City, know enough about it until you know something about the Pendergast era, which, as Terrence points out, dates from the turn of the century all the way through, 1940, Steve.
What I really liked about the film was the footage. They include the first film shot in downtown Kansas City. I live in a building that's from 1886 downtown. I didn't see it in the movie, but I was sure watching for it. And I loved that stuff and seeing all the clubs and the speakeasies down in the West Bottoms.
It almost flashed by too quickly, didn't it?
Well,
the film. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I could have just watched it without the sound. Actually, because I kind of found the story kind of long and drawn out and the narration a little overwrought more than it needed to be. But the sequences, if you've not seen this, all this film of old Kansas City, and it's pretty great.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that Pendergast had never been elected to political office. Pendergast. He became chairman of the Jackson County Democratic Club and wielded a tremendous amount of power, I guess, as a result.
But today, if you look at our city hall downtown and the Jackson County Courthouse downtown, and you want to understand something why the police board is still controlled by the state of Missouri, you have to go back and consider the Pendergast area. Pendergast era, which affects us obviously to this day in very direct ways.
What fascinates me and is a big mystery is how he maintained his integrity, whatever he had. Pendergast and his power when the Kansas City Star was apparently doing political cartoons about him every day, about what a greedy, power-hungry man he was. You know what I mean? How did he stay at the level he did, given that, would that happen today with YouTube and Twitter and all of that?
Well,
probably not.
It's the spoil system where Tom Pendergast simply had control of so many jobs and so much money. He was able to make people indebted to him for so many years. And the footage I found absolutely fascinating for the same reason you were looking for your old building, Steve. The marriage of Tom Pendergast's daughter at Visitation Church at 51st and Main, which was the great societal event of probably for several decades when it occurred back in the 30s, I want to say.
Yeah.
And you see footage of cars pulling up to the church.
In front of his Ward Parkway house.
Yeah,
they have that.
Exactly.
They showed the address even. I don't even know if that house is still standing.
Yeah. But just fun to see.
It was very fun to see
all of
that
those
kind
of
stuff.
Things. So, okay.
And the old nightclubs and all of that is fun. Fun to me than the political minutia that's
It's in limited release, just at local theaters, and I just want to remind people, it's Screenland Crown Center, Screenland Armor, Rio and Overland Park, and the Faro and the Square in Independence. It's worth your time. Very interesting story, Kansas City history.
And this is the weekend to go out and see it because
it
probably won't be around super long.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to another film, Liberal Arts, a campus comedy about a 35-year-old who returns to his alma mater and falls for a college student.
Yes, he does. This movie just pops out of nowhere. They sent the screener like 3 months ago, so I had to go back and read something about it because it's so forgettable. It's written and starring and directed by, when you see those three together, Cynthia and I kind of worry that it's a vanity project.
Too much.
No one's there to cut them off when things get too glib or too soupy or whatever, but it stars Josh Radnor, who apparently is on a show called How I Met Your Mother.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big hit show. I've never seen it. And he plays this, he goes back to his alma mater. He's going to a retirement party for his favorite professor, played by the great Richard Jenkins. And along the way, he falls in love with a young student who's got the annoying name of Zibby. Why? I don't know. Is it a nod to J.D. Salinger or something? I don't know. Played by Elizabeth Olsen, who's also talented.
Mm-hmm.
And
of the Olsen twins.
No, she's the sister who was in Martha, Mary, May, Marlene.
Okay.
She's a good little actress, actually. And the most fun in the movie is Allison Janney, who plays an old teacher of his who doesn't remember him at all. He goes up to her and thinking she'll go, "Oh, yeah, you were the brilliant student in my class." And she's like, "Who are you?"
Yeah.
And he hooks up with her, which in the funniest scene is their post-coital conversation. But the movie is just self-indulgent and bland and not interesting and very forgettable overall. And it opens on a couple screens this weekend.
Didn't get a chance to see it.
So we don't know if we have a shared opinion here. We do have a clip, though, from this.
We do. It's Elizabeth Olsen.
Story movie.
Right. And Josh Radnor, early in their kind of courtship, sitting on a empty stage of an auditorium on campus.
Okay.
Philip, don't you think you're romanticizing youth a bit much? Yeah, because it's just as hard and annoying to be young as it is to be old, I'm assuming. Not that you're old, because, you know, you're not.
Look, I get the whole we're all equal argument, and it's kind of true, but it's also kind of not true. Like, okay, I feel different now than I felt when I was here, and I hate to break this to you, but so will you.
So you're saying things suck? I should prepare myself for suckiness?
No. A liberal arts education solves all your problems.
Thank God.
Worth every penny.
Right.
It didn't work for you.
It doesn't ring. I mean, does that conversation ring like a real no? Conversation, yeah. No, it doesn't.
Interesting idea for a plot, though, I guess. Okay. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're running through some of the latest and best art, independent, and foreign films with Cynthia Haynes and Steve Walker. How about some films already open, Cynthia, and one that all kinds of people are talking about? It's titled Argo. It's a thriller set during the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979.
It is not a documentary. I will start off saying that. Mm-hmm. It is based on a true story, though, that was actually declassified during the Clinton administration, and it was directed by Ben Affleck. He deserves so much credit for doing such a good job with this film. He also did Gone Baby Gone, which I loved. He also did The Town, which was a very good film. And he's evolving into one of those actor/directors who's making very, very entertaining movies.
Didn't he get some help from this film, from some very prominent people?
Well, Kevin Costner did something similar. He talked to him, Robert Redford, Warren Beatty. Actually, George Clooney became one of the producers, and he's done several films as a producer and then also as a director. Mm-hmm. And I think he got some really good advice from them, how to handle it. And it's beautifully edited. It's well-paced. Affleck plays the lead, a guy named Tony Mendez, who is a CIA operative. And he proposes a very far-fetched plan to rescue American hostages in Tehran by disguising them as members of a Canadian film crew.
Well, he's wanting to rescue the seven hostages who got away from the embassy and who weren't held.
Yeah.
They're holed up in the Canadian embassy, which is something we didn't know because it was hidden for so many years.
And the U.S. government gave the Canadians credit for it because they were concerned that if the CIA was linked to this rescue project, that the hostages really would be in serious physical danger.
So and it's all true.
Well, no, and that's the thing. The Mendes has been doing interviews and asked, you know, why are you telling this story now? And he says because he thinks it's worth telling. And there were heroes in this tale. Other people have gone, you know, sort of scene by scene and been asked, you know, did this happen? They'll say, no. You know, what about the escape scene and the plane? You know, they're being chased by trucks and guys with machine guns. Did that happen? No. Mm. You know, so that's all right. Affleck used the term artistic license to create an entertaining, suspenseful, thrilling film. And you know what happens at the end of the movie.
Right.
But it's to his credit that, in fact, he cast it very well. Bryan Cranston plays the CIA boss. He's very good in it. Victor Garber is the Canadian ambassador, Ken Taylor. I found this to be rather interesting. Originally, Affleck was going to film the entire movie in Turkey. And he had trouble finding extras who could speak Farsi and who were willing to play, you know, these characters. Mm-hmm. He goes back to Los Angeles, finds a warehouse that looks quite similar in layout to the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and puts out a call for extras and finds all these people who are willing to be in the movie, speak Farsi, and are, you know, former citizens of Iran. It was really, I thought those scenes were very effective, too, because quite often in these crowd scenes, you can just, you know.
Mm. Well, he opens it with a bang, and this is the embassy is being sieged. besieged, I meant. Mm-hmm. And that's very thrilling and exciting filmmaking because I sort of remember it vaguely.
Well, and it rings true to current events, too, I guess, ironically enough, doesn't it?
There's a prologue that sets things up.
Right.
And I think for a whole generation who don't remember this siege, it's how we got to where we are now. I mean, this was, you know, sort of at the beginning of disastrous relations between the U.S. and the Middle East.
You know, one of the previous films, I guess it was Liberal Arts, where you always sort of cautionary lights start blinking whenever someone writes, directs, and stars in a film. Well, in this film, you mentioned Affleck. He stars in it and he directed it, right?
But he has a lot more talent than Josh Radnor does.
Okay. I mean, I was going to say, how big of a trick is that to pull that off, you know?
It's tough. It's not.
Ben Affleck won an Oscar for his script of Good Will Hunting when he was, 27 something? Very young man. I'm not good with ages on this show, as it's been proven.
Yeah.
But one thing we need to say, though, is that the Canadian people, they want to get them out by having them pose as this film crew for this fictitious science fiction film, thus the title, Argo.
Which I don't think is the best title for the movie.
No,
but,
Mm-hmm. And so there's this comic side plot where Affleck goes to John Goodman's character, who plays a real makeup artist who worked
on
Planet of the Apes movies, and Alan Arkin as his washed-up kind of producer.
Now, he's a fictional character. They made him up.
And they get them involved in this, and so they design storyboards and all of this stuff. So once they're in Tehran, they can pass themselves off. Mm-hmm. They go. There's a very tense scene where they are outside the embassy, which seems to me really foolish, as if to go on a location scout in one of the grand bazaars in the city. And it's crowded. People realize they're not Iranian. What's going on? The tension is just building and building and building. It's very well handled. What I didn't like was the comedy stuff about the film. I thought it was a completely different movie. The tone was off. So of the three films Affleck's made, I think this is his least successful. I thought Gone Baby Gone and The Town were much better movies.
I tend to agree with you there, Steve, about the humor. But I think it diffused some of that tension. And I think that was a clever device that he used, you know, to keep us engaged in the film.
I think it's a little pandering, personally, to that the story isn't involving enough.
But it
seemed part of our history to have this silly Hollywood stuff going on.
You say that, Steve, and yet this film seems to have as much buzz or more buzz than anything he's done before.
Yeah, I think it's doing pretty well.
It's doing very well.
Yeah. And this notion that he directs and he stars in, Cynthia, he pulls this off in your view.
But like I said, he went to other people to ask for advice, you know, and how to handle this. Because what happens when you're directing yourself is you lose perspective. And you need someone over your shoulder. Now, the word has always been that Kevin Costner's cinematographer directed all the movies that he supposedly directed and starred in.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
But
they have a very close relationship, any director and any cinematographer, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's the clip we have?
We have
here?
A clip of the least successful part of the film, actually, for me. But that's John Goodman and Alan Arkin are talking in Hollywood, looking for a project.
How about the Horses of Achilles?
No good. Nobody does westerns anymore.
It's ancient Troy.
If it's got horses in it, it's a western.
Yeah, Kenny, please. Yeah, it's John Chambers about the Office Space.
It doesn't matter.
It's a fake movie.
If I'm doing a fake movie, it's going to be a fake hit.
Hey, is A006 still on the open list? Yeah, I'll hold.
Fade in on a starship landing. An exotic Middle Eastern vibe. Women gather, offering ecstatic libations to the sky gods. Argo, science fantasy adventure.
It's in turnaround.
Can we get the option?
Why do we need the option?
You're worried about the Ayatollah? Try the WGA.
He's referring to the Writers Guild of America.
That's from Argo. Two thumbs up from Steve and Cynthia for that one from Ben Affleck. How about this one? Seven Psychopaths, a psycho killer comedy about eccentric friends who inadvertently kidnap the dog of a ruthless gangster. Probably not a good idea.
It's not inadvertent. Sam Rockwell and Christopher Walken are dog nappers. That's what they do. They go to the La Brea Tar Pits or other places where Beverly Hills people who they think will have money and They'll take the dogs for a while, then show up going, oh, I found your dog, and people give them, if they're lucky. It's a scam, like right out of the... Wow.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, and what happens is the dog in question, who we see throughout the film, is a Shih Tzu named Bonnie, who belongs to Woody Harrelson, who's very funny as this crazed, crazy psychopath. At the same time, what's holding this movie together is the through line is that Colin Farrell is playing a screenwriter who has a drinking problem, who's writing a script called Seven Psychopaths, and his best friend, Sam Rockwell, becomes one of the seven psychopaths, and they're sort of identified in the first 5 minutes. This is a film from a playwright I very much respect, and his last film was very good, In Bruges, Martin McDonagh.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the best plays I've seen in this city and in New York are from him, like Cripple of Inishmore and Lieutenant of Inishmore and The Pillow Man and some things like that. He's got a great wit and style about him. He's able to do dark comedy in a way that's entertaining while being disturbing. And then in the last 5 minutes, he has to use a couple words that are really derogatory terms for gay people that completely turned me off the film. I was enjoying it so much. Mm-hmm. And then this completely gratuitous use of two words, I was like, why did he have to do that? That is so lazy.
Mm. Well, there's also another scene, Steve, where Gabby Sidibe, who was in Precious,
gosh, yeah.
I was so offended by that scene. They're making fun of her weight. They're making fun of her. They're, you know, on the verge of torturing her and killing her. And I thought, why in the maybe she's not being offered other roles, but why in the world she would be in this film? I don't know. And I'm off base here with so many other critics who I respect. Who think that this is one of the funniest, entertaining movies of the year. David Denby said it's the kind of film that can lift somebody up after they've had a bad day at work.
And I felt sick to my stomach when I left. I mean, hear me out. I really thought it was entertaining. His writing, he tells stories that are really disturbing.
But I think he's a better playwright and director for the stage than he is a filmmaker. I think this just got away from him, and it became totally absurd. I'm flashing on Tarantino. I mean, someone else even used the term Tarantino light. It just didn't work for me.
I enjoyed watching Woody Harrelson. I always do. Colin Farrell's not been better in a long time because he gets to play someone who's Irish, and so he doesn't have to work at some kind of accent.
Tom Waits is kind of amusing.
And Christopher Walken's very funny.
Yeah.
But there are these moments in it that you just go, wow, this is really brutal. And sometimes for a reason to further the plot. Sometimes, as I mentioned at the end, for no discernible reason except to be coy and punky and offensive.
So I gather there are some moments in this film that are hard to watch.
Yes.
So be forewarned.
Yeah.
Okay. Stephen, what's the clip we have here from Seven Psychopaths?
This is... Sam Rockwell, Christopher Walken, the dog napper buddies, and Colin Farrell are taking off into the desert because they've learned that the owner of the Shih Tzu is a crazed psychopath. So this is them talking in the car.
As Gandhi said...
Oh, if it ain't Gandhi, Jesus Christ.
An eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind. I believe that wholeheartedly.
No, it doesn't. There'll be one guy left with one eye. How's the last blind guy gonna take out the eye of the last guy left, who's still got one eye? All that guy has to do is run away and hide behind a bush. Gandhi was wrong. Just that nobody's got the to come right out and say it.
Let me just say, Martin McDonagh, some of the best plays I've ever seen were written by this man.
Mm-hmm.
The last play I saw of his, A Behanding in Spokane, with Walken, with Sam Rockwell, one of the worst plays I've ever seen. I don't know what's happening to his career. I really don't.
Well, I'd never realized how important he was, but this season he has the distinction of having four plays staged simultaneously in London,
mm-hmm.
which is
that's pretty impressive. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our review of the latest art, independent, and foreign films with Cynthia Haynes and Steve Walker. We'll turn to The Perks of Being a Wallflower and one other one, Searching for a Sugar Man, a documentary about the resurrection of the career of a Detroit musician named Sixto Rodriguez that a lot of folks have raved about. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Just a quick note here. Tom and Harry, the boss and the president, is playing at the Glenwood Arts, not the Rio. Just a quick correction there to earlier listings as we talk about the latest art, independent, and foreign films. And by the way, if you missed yesterday's conversation with our Texperts, you can find it and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On Monday's program, we take a satirical look at cats, cartoons, and the world with the artist behind the Oatmeal comic strip. Plus, we'll discuss plans for a new terminal out at KCI. Lots of folks talking about that. Well, again, this hour, we're talking films with Cynthia Haynes and Steve Walker. We've done a bunch. We'll have them all listed on our website later on today, kcur.org. Let's move on to, here to a film, The Perks of Being a Wallflower. Steve Walker, withdrawn high school freshman, befriends two misfit seniors.
Exactly, and it's based on the memoir of Stephen Chbosky. I don't know. I'm not familiar with his work. Apparently it was a hit book. And
young adult book.
Yeah, a young adult book. So I think he's the young man, the freshman, who's, we learned, been somewhere, and he's coming into the school. He's been away. He's really nervous, and he doesn't know anybody, as freshmen do.
I was there once.
Oh, I know.
Tough stuff.
And he befriends these two people, Patrick and Sam. Patrick is Ezra Miller, who played the complete psycho in We Need to Talk About Kevin. He was that murderous kid in that family. Here he's playing a sweet gay kid who's an outsider, but yet he doesn't care what people think of him. And his stepsister is played by Emma Watson, Sam, from the Harry Potter movies, you hear nothing of her English accent. I think she's very cute in this. So there's this group of teens who aren't the jocks, who aren't the cheerleaders, who aren't the, you know, the superstars in the school. And they kind of take to him for some reason. And we kind of watch his anguish at trying to infiltrate this group. There's a scene at a dance where he's against the wall, thus the term wallflower, seeing them dancing together. And we watch this long shot of him getting the courage to go to them. And I think it's one of the better movies about teenagers I've seen in a long time.
People are calling it the Breakfast Club for the new millennium.
Wow.
There's some really good stuff in it, some really touching stuff, some funny stuff, and then the last 15 minutes are pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah.
When we learn about his backstory and why he's so tortured. Mm.
This story is set in 1991, and there's some very good music.
Yes, the New Order, the Smiths, all kinds of great music. Yeah. David Bowie's Heroes.
Yeah.
Oh, I love the movie. Mm-hmm. I was so impressed, and I thought it's another one of those low-budget teen angst movies, and how interesting is this going to be? I was engaged from the get-go, I think.
Really?
And because of the talent of these three young actors, Logan Lerman, who plays Charlie, Ezra Miller, Patrick, and Emma Watson, I thought, was the weakest of the three. But, you know, I hope she breaks out of her stereotyped
Clip we're going to hear is at a party. This group likes to party a little bit and sets rules different from all the other kids I was talking about. But here they've kind of made the decision that they're going to welcome Charlie into their group.
Hey, everyone. Everybody. Raise your glasses to Charlie.
What did I do?
You didn't do anything. We just want to toast our new friend. You see things, and you understand. You're a wallflower. What is it? What's wrong?
I didn't think anyone noticed me.
Well, we didn't think there was anyone cool left to meet. So, come on, everyone, to Charlie.
To Charlie.
Welcome to the island of misfit toys.
What a great line.
Yeah.
Yikes.
I'd like to mention that our Paul Rudd is in it. He plays
an
ultra-cool English teacher, and he didn't need to play that part, but I think he lent his star power to some extent to get this movie made, and I just think it's wonderful.
And so, Logan Lerman, one more thing about this guy who plays Charlie, because he is the movie, I mean, around which these things happen. He's got these eyes that are like the color of turquoise, wet turquoise, and so his brokenness is all there, and he does a really nice job.
Would this be a good film to take
Oh, yes. Definitely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Take kids to this movie.
The Perks of Being a Wallflower, two big thumbs up from Steve and Cynthia here as we review the latest art, independent, and foreign films. Now showing, how about this film? Too bad Bob Butler's not here today because he raves about this film. Searching for Sugar Man, a documentary about the resurrection of the career of a Detroit musician named Sixto Rodriguez.
This is a very entertaining detective story.
Mm.
It was directed by a Swedish TV director, and I believe he shot it with his smartphone. That's one I read in one place. There is some documentary footage and their interviews, but anyway, point being, it's a very low budget film, but very high budget quality documentary. As far as I'm concerned, it was showing once again at the True False Film Festival in Columbia, Missouri. That's coming up in March, and we had a chance to see it back then.
I did not. I didn't get to see it then, and I haven't seen it yet. So.
Yeah, but I think it's going to be making the rounds for consideration for an Oscar.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
This guy, Rodriguez, was born, he was a Mexican-American singer and songwriter, born in Detroit. He released two albums, Cold Fact and another one called Coming From Reality, and then just kind of dropped off the face of the earth. And there were all these rumors, these fantastic rumors about his death, that maybe it was a suicide and that he set himself on fire on stage. And so, you know, we're talking a while back here, so there was no fact-checking on the internet. I mean, people just really didn't know. And he became revered in all places, South Africa, because white young apartheid protesters, the Afrikaners, felt like he was singing their songs, their protest songs.
Mm-hmm.
And Rodriguez's music was banned in South Africa, but of course there was a whole underground. And at that time, there were cassette tapes, so you could just churn them out. And then finally, in 1997, one of his daughters saw a website about him and about what a hero he was in South Africa, and so things started to explode from that point. And one of his biggest fans came from South Africa and started hunting him down and used some of his lyrics to try to locate where he might be. And then in – I don't want to give away too much, and I read Butler's review, and it's the same thing. If you know too much about it, some of the – and there's surprise after surprise throughout the documentary. But needless to say, he recently played a concert in Columbia, Missouri. And I would describe his music a little bit like James Taylor, but with a bit of a political edge.
Hmm. Boy, it sounds interesting. Everyone, it seems to have some interest in this film, that's for sure.
Well, he's 70 years old now, and people are saying, is he going to do another album? He might, and, you know, he just doesn't have the money to do that at this point. But here's hoping he does. But it's a wonderful story.
His name again, Sixto Rodriguez. What's the clip we have here, Cynthia?
Well, we have one of his fans talking about the fact that he had Rodriguez had created the soundtrack for the lives of these Afrikaners who are opposed to apartheid.
This is from Searching for Sugar Man.
The album was exceptionally popular. To many of us South Africans, he was the soundtrack to our lives. In the mid-70s, if you walked into a random white liberal middle-class household that had a turntable and a pile of pop records, and if you flipped through the records, you would always see Abbey Road by the Beatles, you would always see Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon & Garfunkel, and you would always see Cold Fact by Rodriguez. To us, it was one of the most famous records of all time. The message it had was, be anti-establishment. And the one song's called the Anti-Establishment Blues. We didn't know what the word anti-establishment was until it cropped up on a Rodriguez song. And then we found out it's okay to protest against your society, to be angry with your society.
Again, from Searching for Sugar Man.
Yes, it's at the Tivoli and the Fine Arts. I would really recommend this
movie
this weekend.
Big thumbs up from Cynthia Haynes and a big thumbs up from Bob Butler, who unfortunately is not here today. Okay, let's move on to a film I'm interested in, Samsara, because I saw this film. This is a stunning nonverbal art film that takes you to 25 countries on five continents. And I wanted just to mention that last weekend, Sunday afternoon, not much going on. I wanted to go out and see a film. And I went to our website, kcur.org, and looked up your three to see for the weekend, which is something I do. You hadn't been on for a few weeks. Had sort of lost track of what was out and what was new. And on our website, we keep a list from Steve and Cynthia, what are the best films in their view to go out and see on any given weekend. And it usually works for me very, very well. And it worked for me really well last weekend. I went out and saw this film, which is very different. But boy, I just was absorbed by it and just got a big kick out of it, Cynthia.
Yes, the two filmmakers had worked on a film in 1992 called Baraka. And some people have been critical and say, well, it's, you know, a lot of similar stuff. We're talking about scenes accompanied by music. The music was added after the fact. But we've got Asian dancers, monks, African tribesmen, disaster zones, industrial complexes, sacred grounds, natural wonders that are all knitted together, I think, in a rather profound way.
It's a very disparate sort of set of scenes. There's no rhyme or reason. And also, there's nothing on the screen that tells you where you are.
That's
and
right.
At first, it bothered me a little bit, but after a while, you sort of get into the flow of things, if only because I'd also read that the word samsara, the title of this film, means the ever-turning wheel of life. And that helped me very quickly understand what was going on here.
And that's what happened. I mean, I did see some connections, and I'm going to mention a couple, and they may come back to you. There was portraits of some African villagers ornately made up and accessorized. In the next shot, it's a heavily tattooed Latino holding his infant.
Yes, yes.
Another one is there's someone looking right into the camera. Again, it's from an African village with these elongated braids streaming down their head. Mm-hmm. The next shot is this overhead shot of the ribbons of highways in L.A. And I only caught those two. I'm sure there's a lot more. But it is just about this planet is huge. This planet is big, but yet
and all kinds of stuff's going on.
Of stuff's going on, but there are things that connect us, whether that's architecture or rites and rituals,
right.
Family,
very
all
well
those
said.
Kinds of things.
Very well said.
Ron Fricke and Mark McGibson, who made this film, shot it in 70 millimeter, which in this day and age, I mean, can use your cell phone to make movies, they're lugging the 70 millimeter equipment around. So you've got to see it on a big screen.
Yes, this one you've got to see on a big screen.
You know, it's showing at the Tivoli, and it is just magnificent. It's sharp and rich, and you know, you need a really good sound system, too. The music is by Michael Stearns and Lisa Gerard. She's with a group called Dead Can Dance. I'm not familiar with their music. And Marcello De Francisci. And, it creates sort of a hypnotic effect as you're watching it. Again, no dialogue, no subtitles.
And so many of these scenes are simply spectacular. You really can't undersell how amazing are some of the scenes you're looking at.
You can't watch it on your iPad.
You know, one scene you're shooting through a canyon with these incredibly grooved walls help
sandstone,
take you along the way. Yeah. And
waiting to see James Franco caught by a rock.
Yeah, I guess. But it's just, you know, and next moment you're looking at a portrait of a dancer, just a very intense portrait just of the face.
Right.
And then things begin to happen, and it just you can't take your eyes off the screen.
One more comment about a shot. There's a shot of people at Mecca celebrating, doing this circuitous dance around it. It's shot from so high up.
Yes.
I first thought it was a whirlpool in an ocean, and then you just kind of go, oh, those are people.
Or the scene of the inmates in the prison wearing the
dancing,
orange jumpsuits, dancing.
Yeah.
And at first you're sort of like, what are we doing here? What's going on? And then they begin to dance, and the whole thing is choreographed so magnificently that you're like, wow.
Yeah.
You know? They also use time-lapse photography in a beautiful way.
Yes, an amazing way. Yeah. As you can tell, I think we're all excited about Samsara. We can't play a clip because all you would hear is music and there really isn't any dialogue to this film. But it's something different, and maybe it's worth your consideration to go take a look at it. How about Pitch Perfect, a raunchy girl flick set in the competitive world of college a cappella groups, Cynthia?
Well, another one of those movies, you know, I really think we ought to cover it. It's, you know, I think it was at Sundance. It's a
very low budget.
Very low budget kind of thing. And I thought, well, how funny could this be? Anna Kendrick is in it, and she plays an introverted college freshman who becomes a very aggressive recruit of this a cappella group in this fictitious college. and does a really wonderful job. There are laugh out loud moments in that. Yeah, I was embarrassed to laugh. It's kind of a chick flick for, you know, what are some of those raunchy guy flicks?
Like The Hangover. And
It's a female version.
And I'm like, bring on the raunchy girl flick movies, because Bridesmaids was so funny and so well done. There was another one that is on demand right now called Bachelorette with Kirsten Dunst. It's very funny. Yeah. And it also has Rebel Wilson in it, who is the thread through this. She was Kristen Wiig's strange British roommate in Bridesmaids. You may remember the scene where she hurt her back and she said, put frozen peas on it. So she opens the bag of peas and pours them on her back. She's a very heavy blonde girl. She is hilarious. And then she's in Bachelorette. Not cast against type, actually, as the one member of this quartet of girlfriends who's getting married. And Kirsten Dunst is the hot mess in the movie, not Rebel Wilson. Mm-hmm. And now in this film, she again steals scenes like she's got a license to,
she's got
a gun in her hand. Yeah. She's very funny. Hollywood is picking up on her. I just read this week that one of the studios has bought a script that she wrote that will star her. So now, just Google her. You'll know her face. Everybody saw Bridesmaids.
Rebel Wilson. And she's an Australian comic.
Oh, she's Australian. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who can sing and dance. And she does a very good job here. So if you're a Glee fan, let me at least say, or you're into the TV talent competitions such as The Voice, you really might get a kick out of a glimpse into this world. I saw it at the Southwind Theater in Lawrence, and it was there were quite a few trios of KU female students who were in the audience just rolling in the aisles laughing at things
really?
I think a lot of guys might not get. But
I thought it was pretty funny.
Yeah.
I got it.
Okay.
But what's also entertaining about it is that it's one of those predictable competition movies where everything's building up to this big competition. But this female a cappella group is really tired. And the judges, who were very funny, played by John Michael Higgins from the Christopher Guest movies, and Elizabeth Banks, the actress who produced it.
Wiig was supposed to be in that
part. Oh, was she?
But
yeah.
Banks was one of the co-producers of this movie. So, yeah.
So they're kind of stuck in a rut, and they come out and they do this old Ace of Base song, I Saw the Sign. And everyone's going, oh, not them again, at these various competitions. And Anna Kendrick's character is a DJ, and that's her real love, and she mixes up and does mashups and all this kind of stuff. So she takes it upon herself to, in the middle of their set, start to mix it up a little bit. She produces her own mashup to their amazement and unexpected surprise.
In a positive response.
In a positive
from the
response.
Yeah.
People love it.
Yeah.
Mm. And Kendrick, people will know her from Up in the Air. She was nominated for that, Best Supporting Actress, playing George Clooney's neurotic, tense co-partner. She was nominated for a Tony for a musical when she was 12. So she has the vocal chops.
I didn't realize that.
And she does sing well. We've got a clip.
Yeah.
Cynthia, what is it?
We've got the obnoxious leader of the a cappella group and her second in command, Chloe, having a conversation.
This is from Pitch Perfect.
I hope you all remember the way you feel right now, so you will never want to feel this way again. Chloe, your voice didn't sound Aguilarian at all. Chloe, for serious, what is wrong with you? I have nodes.
What? Oh, my God. I found out this morning.
What are nodes?
Vocal nodules. The rubbing together of your vocal cords at above average rates without proper lubrication. They sit on your windpipe and they crush your dreams.
Isn't that painful? Why would you keep performing?
Because I love to sing.
Yeah, it's like when my lady doctor told me not to have sex for 6 weeks, and I did it anyway.
You should really listen to your doctor.
The key is early diagnosis. I am living with notes, but I am a survivor. I just have to pull back because I am limited, because I have notes. Chloe, this is horrible.
Well, at least it's not herpes. Oh dear, I have that as well.
That was Rebel Wilson at the end. She improvised a lot of her lines, I'm told.
That's from Pitch Perfect. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the latest art, independent foreign films, now showing with Steve Walker and Cynthia Haynes. Cynthia, tell us about Atlas Shrugged Part 2. Maybe Paul Ryan's listening here. Based on the epic 1957 novel, it's a story of the glory of capitalism and the evil of federal regulations.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what I was listening to at the beginning of this film, whether it was a political debate or, well, anyway, it's...
I don't think there's any debate in this film.
Well, no, that's...
it's
well,
all
there
pretty
is
one-sided.
Between the government regulators and... anyway, this is based on an epic novel by Ayn Rand, and it's 1,000 pages long. It's the world's greatest doorstop. I think everybody in college tried to start it at one time or another and never finished it. Right.
Except Paul Ryan.
Yeah. And it's about the adventures of super businesswoman Dagny Taggart, who inherited her family's Transcontinental Railroad, and she thinks she's found the solution to the global energy crisis because gasoline is now at $40 a gallon, and the world economy is on the brink of collapse. This is a film in defense, or a story, actually. The first one, Atlas Shrugged Part 1, did not do very well at the box office, and this is a movie that's made for the believers, the true believers.
Is this entertaining? Is it educational? What
is
it?
Well, it's supposed to be, and it falls far from the mark. It really does. It's very amateurish.
If part one didn't do very well, why'd they come out with part two?
Well, I'm really not sure. And there were arguments. You know, they had difficulty finding the funding, and they couldn't get the actors from part one to be in part two. And they're considering a part three. But I, you know, they're just
God love them.
Bleeding money.
There's an audience for it, I suppose.
There
Cynthia
is.
Took
you
the bullet. No.
Yeah.
No.
No. No.
Cynthia took the bullet for the team again.
But it's I did, and I I get more points here.
What's the clip we have here?
I think we've got Hank Reardon, who plays the married love interest of the actress or Dagny Taggart, another industrialist. He has a steel company, and so he's arguing with a member of the government who wants to take over his business.
This is from Atlas Shrugged, Part 2.
So you're not here to take something from me you didn't earn yourself?
You can't just reject a government order for your materials.
Why can't I?
It's an essential needs project.
Essential to whom?
It's very important. It's for the State Science Institute.
Well, the State Science Institute declared Reardon metal unfit. They did so very publicly, nearly ruined my company. So tell me, why does the SSI now need 10,000 tons of my dangerous inferior metal?
You laid 100 miles of track along the John Galt line that proved them wrong.
You still haven't answered my question. Why? To what purpose?
Rest assured, Mr. Reardon, it's in the public interest.
I'll rest on this. You tell your people that I will not sell any Reardon metal to the State Science Institute at any time, for any price, for any purpose whatsoever.
Mr. Reardon, no one has ever refused to sell a strategic material to the government. It's against the fair share law. You have to sell it to them.
I'll make it simple for you. Tell them I won't accept payment. Now, they're welcome to come down here with their trucks and their guns and seize as much metal as they want.
That would be theft.
Damn, son. You're brighter than you look.
Ayn Rand is a proponent of, or was, she's no longer living, but she has quite a following.
Oh, absolutely.
Of objectivism, and she wrote that the theme of Atlas Shrugged was what happens to the world when the prime movers go on strike. The first question to decide is on whom the emphasis must be placed, on the prime movers, the parasites, or the world. Does that ring a bell? Have we heard something along those
lines? I was
lines?
Asleep as soon as you started it. But there, you can make a good movie out of an Ayn Rand book, and that would be The Fountainhead with Gary Cooper and Patricia Neal.
Yeah. We just have a couple minutes left here and all kinds of things to announce. But one thing I wanted to ask was coming up soon, I think in a few weeks, is Steven Spielberg's Lincoln and also Hyde Park on Hudson, the film where Bill Murray plays FDR. What do we know about these two films? Are they going to – people
huge buzz on the Lincoln film.
Lincoln
Daniel
looks
Day.
Very
Daniel
good.
Day-Lewis. Oh,
yeah. Sally Fields playing Mary Todd Lincoln. Tommy Lee Jones is in it. Just a huge cast. I hear great things about, of course, Daniel Day-Lewis's work in the film. Hyde Park on the Hudson. It looks good. Bill Murray's playing FDR.
Yeah.
They're recreating the time that the Duke and Duchess of Windsor went to Hyde Park and stayed at the Roosevelt's house.
So two films about two of our most iconic presidents.
Yeah, to really absolutely. Look forward yeah. to. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
What else do you want to single out here, Cynthia?
Bob
just in the
Butler
minute we
has
left.
This wonderful series going, Movies That Matter.
Yeah.
He's going to do showing Murnau's 1922 silent classic masterpiece Nosferatu, which is the grandfather of all vampire movies, at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library, Sunday, October the 28th. And then the Tivoli is presenting the National Theater Live. This is a wonderful series that brings you right, you know, to the best theater in England. The Last of the Hossmans is showing, a new play by Stephen Beresford with Julie Waters, Rory.
Are these productions working? Are people showing up?
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah. I have missed the last couple, but you remember me raving about Frankenstein, yes. the first one that yes. played here.
Yeah. Yeah, check out the Tivoli's website and you'll get the dates and times. Also, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, it will be the first theater in the country to show this remastered, digitalized film.
I know every line of that movie, unfortunately.
Okay, just really quickly, the three top films showing this week that the two of you would recommend, Steve Walker.
The Master, the best film out there. End of Watch, second best, with Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena's L.A. Cops. Mm-hmm. And The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Oh, I'll do Argo, Sugar Man, and The Master.
Okay. That's a good way to wrap up our show today. I want to thank Steve Walker and Cynthia Haynes. And again, you can find their list of films we reviewed today and their three favorites showing on area screens at kcur.org. Thanks for coming in, guys. Always good to have
you. Thank you. Yeah.
Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Monday on the program, we talked to the man behind the pen of the satirical comic strip The Oatmeal, and we'll talk with the aviation director from Kansas City, Missouri, about plans for a new terminal at KCI. Our show's music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help this week from KCUR's Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Bill Anderson, and Kim Noble. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.